This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Now, we've joked before on Drive that bird watchers have the best gossip, and this month it feels like all the feathers flying at once. Our favourite bird nerd has just returned from the Australasian Ornithological Conference in Perth, which has to be the most impossible to pronounce conference title ever, but we've done it. That was the tongue twister.
Sean Dooley, Joy Drive's chief bird nerd.
Good afternoon, Sean Dooley.
Good afternoon, Warren. That was a pretty good attempt, I have to say.
Did I say? It is a difficult one, isn't it? Ornithological. Is that right?
Yes, it is. I thought you put an H in at the front, and I thought, oh, that's a completely different kind of conference.
Well, the birds are a bit at the moment, aren't they?
Yes, they are. In fact, I noticed yesterday a magpie swooping somebody's dog. So, in a park, actually in Yarra Park near the MCG, and I said, "Oh, that's very late," because as we've discussed, magpies only swoop when they're when they have chicks in the nest. So, maybe all this rain that we had in November has sparked a new fresh round of breeding in some of our birds this spring, because it was pretty dry early on, but now, with all the rain, there's a lot more growth and insects around. So maybe the birds are having another go.
Sean, I've got the pest miner, the Indian miner, stealing my blueberries. And they watch me. They look at my, because my kitchen faces the blueberries, and they wait until I've moved away from the sink, and then they come in and they pick them. And I chase them. It's quite, you know, it'd be quite funny to watch, because I run out and I'm trying to chain my train my dog to get them as well, but they've eaten them all.
So they win this year. Yeah, it is funny. There was some funny news out about gulls out of England, where they've done a lot of studies on, because even though there's about 3 or 4 different species of gull in England that are quite, well, were once quite common, but they're all declining. Except they're all moving into the cities, and there's, you know, the British love their fish and chips on the beach. Well, so do the gulls. And so there's been a lot of research into how the gulls steal the chips. And one research was that firstly, they only tend to eat food that's on the ground that they've watched people eat. So they're watching us all the time. And then they'll only cut, basically a watched chip rarely gets stolen. So they wait until you turn away, and then they're in as quickly as they can. But there was this other study, and it seems quite ridiculous, but they did studies with people saying things to gulls to see if they would go away and not eat their food. And apparently they only did the study with men, unfortunately. So, but it was the deepest voice and the most angry voice of the men that they tried meant that the gulls backed off. So, and they had some ridiculous script like, "Don't eat my pasty," or something like that. The gulls, like those miners, they watch us and they know when the opportunity is there to grab the food.
Sean, there'll be toys soon with, that you take to the beach that say that.
Yes. Hey, there's a marketing opportunity for us.
I reckon too. Now, you've been at this conference, the Ornithological Conference, in the swing of saying it now. What's the latest out of there? Were people feeling hopeful? Were they worried? Were they energised? What are the birds telling us?
Yeah, well, I mean, there was a lot of discussion about threatened species, and this was, a scientific conference. So it was quite inspiring and energizing, because you got to see what these amazing people are doing with their research and how they're using new techniques to try and identify where birds are and how to save them, and things like using what we call acoustic monitoring, which is putting out basically recorders in the field, so that and then use going back and listening to thousands of hours of recording to see if we can pick up any calls of threatened species. And interestingly, this is an area where AI is being put to good use. They're developing call recognizers so that instead of getting poor volunteers to sit there and have to listen to thousands of hours of landscape recording, they just run it through a computer, and once it learns the calls, it can pick up when or can flag when it thinks that there's a rare species calling, so people can go and check on it. So those sorts of things were really fascinating to see. But also it happened at quite a momentous time for birds and bird conservation and conservation in general in the past week or two. While we were over in Perth, news came through that confirmation of the first bird flu, the H5N1 strain on Australian territory, was confirmed, this time in elephant seals, not actually in any of the birds, on Heard Island, which is an Australian territory about 4,000 kilometres west of Perth in the Southern Ocean. But so it's still a long way off mainland Australia, so there's no need to panic just yet. But the fact that it's now on Australian soil is very disconcerting. And the fact that no dead or sick birds were seen, but there was a number of dead elephant seals. And we know from places like Antarctica and South America, at the bottom of South America, that the bird flu has managed to jump into mammals like seals. And then in North America, it's got into things like cattle. So it's a bit of a concern. But at the moment, Australia and New Zealand, mainland Australia and New Zealand, are the only places in the world where this bird flu hasn't arrived. So fingers crossed, it only stays on Heard Island and doesn't get here anytime soon.
Sean, let's assume that it does get here. How prepared are we for it?
Yeah, it's interesting. It's almost impossible to prepare for. Like, it's not like we can go and vaccinate all the wild birds. But they are looking at trying to vaccinate threatened species populations if they're in the one spot. They're doing this in New Zealand, where they have a number of threatened species on that they protect on predator-free islands, like the kakapo, that amazing nighttime-dwelling flightless parrot that almost went extinct. And they don't want a disease like that to get in and wipe them out. But they're able to catch those birds and give them the double dose that they need 2 weeks apart to have full immunity. We can't really do that with all of our birds in Australia. I mean, we've just finished the Aussie bird count, where about 70,000 people counted, around 5 million birds in sort of suburban and city areas. So imagine trying to catch 5 million, even those 5 million birds, and inoculate them against the bird flu. So when it gets here, it's going to be pretty devastating, because our birds in Australia haven't evolved with this highly pathogenic strain of flu before. So that, it could take a huge toll, particularly on our water birds like swans and pelicans. So the preparedness is more to be prepared for when the outbreak does occur, so we can monitor where it is and try and limit the spread if possible, which is going to be a really difficult ask, because you can't, if you go into, say, a nesting colony or a lake where there's a large number of birds, some of them are going to fly away, and they might have the virus with them. So it is of great concern, but what we're going to have to focus on is to make sure that our bird populations are resilient in other ways, because if they're getting hammered by a disease, and they're also under stress because of poor conditions of their habitat or loss of habitat, or, they're constantly stressed by, especially if this happens in duck season when people are shooting ducks, that's just going to be a nightmare, because you've got people coming in, taking out potentially infected birds from the zones, taking out potentially, getting the virus on their equipment and spreading it that way. But also the birds will be stressed, they'll be flying around, they're going to move around a lot more and potentially spread it to other birds when they land on the safe wetlands. So it's kind of our worst case scenario, that if bird flu does arrive, because when it arrives, it's going to arrive with the seabirds or the water birds, like the migratory birds that tend to flock and congregate in large flocks. It's not going to turn up in your backyard magpie straight away or anything like that. So people don't need to panic about that yet. But if it does get here, we really need to keep a track on where it's going and helping the birds as best we can to get through this.
Sean, if it does arrive, is the Victorian government sort of worded up to say, hey, we need to make sure that our birds are healthy and that there is no duck shooting season, all this sort of thing? Is that on the table? Is that being discussed with them?
Well, we at BirdLife Australia, that's the recommendations we're making to them, and that they're going to be contemplating what they do for duck shooting season next year. So we're making sure we're advocating to, hey, let's just put a moratorium on this. The risk is too great. You would hope that if certainly the governments have been sort of scenario planning for this, and there is a response in play. I think something like $96 million has been put towards preparing for the arrival of bird flu. But I think a lot of that money has gone into sort of, you know, this will affect the poultry industry as well. So a lot of that money may have gone more into working out how to protect domestic flocks of birds and things like that. So let's hope, you know, that we've had a couple of scares last year. We had outbreaks of bird deaths at seabird colonies. And as it turned out, it was like, say, it was kind of like a botulism poisoning or something like that from just the water quality not being good. And so we avoided bird flu last year. But that was an interesting test case because you have to identify that there are sick or injured or dead, dying birds and make sure that, you know, nobody goes in there, but then the authorities can go in to actually test for it. And it's going to be quite a complex situation.
Sean, what can we all do as individuals to help prepare our bird life in the event that it does arrive?
Yeah, I think, I suppose the be alert and not alarmed catchphrase is applicable to this situation because it's not here yet. And we know that birds can die from a lot of different things. Like, so if you see an individual bird on the ground, it's almost at this stage, it's not bird flu. You know, if, for instance, if you're one of your miners suddenly eating a blueberry turned up its toes, it's it's almost impossible that it would be a bird flu. It's going to be something else because a lot of birds get killed by a lot of things, I'm afraid. But we do need to be alert, and there is a national wildlife disease hotline that people can ring. If they see collections of five or more birds that have either died or look very sick, and by that it's like they've got droopy necks, they can't fly, they're sort of swimming around in circles or they're staggering around, that's, you know, the trouble is there's a lot of things that mimic the symptoms of bird flu. So it's really important that we identify where we see birds like that exhibiting those symptoms, and we notify that hotline and try and get the authorities out to test to see what it actually is.
We're chatting with Sean Dooley, National Public Affairs Manager at BirdLife Australia, getting the latest in from the bird world. Sean, let's talk about the big push from Labor to move nature laws through Parliament. Is BirdLife Australia happy with those laws?
We're happy that we have something now. It's been a long campaign. BirdLife Australia, I remember starting to campaign on the need to fix what were our broken nature laws. 9 years ago, we started campaigning on this with other conservation organisations because our nature laws were cooked. They didn't do what it said on the label, and we were just seeing more and more threatened species added every year because there were massive, the loopholes in our previous nature laws at a federal level were so large you could drive a logging truck through them. And Labor came in to power promising to make reforms. It fell over at the last minute in the last first Albanese government. In this second term with the new environment minister, determined to get it through. It was right up to the wire, and initially the first stages of the proposal for these changes, they had some really good things in it, things we've been really wanting for years, like an EPA to actually monitor and regulate nature laws, and also a promise of some national standards, which haven't been delivered yet, but they've promised they're going to do that. We don't know what those standards are. But the bill itself, as Labor presented, wasn't great. There were still a lot of loopholes, still too much ministerial discretion to override what the scientific experts say. And, you know, over the years, every time, like, the government would put up a bill and the Greens or whoever would want to negotiate on it, you know, the catchphrase was, you know, don't let perfect be the enemy of good. But to them, I would say, well, yeah, you know what else is the enemy of good? Something that's shit. Yeah. And so this bill that got put up by Labor was half good and half a bit shit. Yeah. And there was lots of negotiations between Labor and the Coalition, Labor and the Greens, to pass it through the upper house. And last Thursday, Labor and the Greens did agree to some amendments. And definitely the amendments the Greens got plugged up a lot of those holes and loopholes, including the fact that for the first time now we can include native forest logging as something to consider in nature laws. We had this ridiculous situation where the swift parrot is going extinct because its habitat is being logged in native forests in Tasmania and New South Wales. And the old nature laws said, well, because there's a regional forest agreement, the environment laws don't apply. And so basically we were watching this bird go extinct due to the forestry. And the Commonwealth government was saying, well, there's nothing we can do. Well, now there is something they can do. The Greens managed to get that exemption for regional forest agreements off the table, so that just like any other development now, if a development threatens, endangered species, then it needs to be looked at, and action needs to be taken to address it. The big question now with these nature laws is what the standards are that they're going to set, and that they haven't told us that. So what is going to trigger the protection of the nature laws is still up for grabs. So we're at BirdLife Australia, we're pretty happy with the outcome in that we have stronger architecture to protect our threatened birds. But what we don't know yet is what building materials they're using to prop up that architecture. So, you know, to stretch the analogy a bit, you know, is there going to be flywire screens in the windows? Mm-hmm. What are the walls going to be built out of? Something solid or something flimsy? We just don't know the details yet, but it's definitely overall a positive and promising start, but there's still some concerning gaps.
Sean, always good to chat with you. We've run out of time, but we'll talk to you next month.
Excellent. Thanks very much, Warren.
Thank you. That's Sean Dooley, National Public Affairs Manager at BirdLife Australia.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.